It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're talking with Dr. Kat, epidemiologist. She uses the social media platform TikTok to break down complicated pandemic-related science into digestible 60-second videos like this one.
Hi, Dr. Kat, epidemiologist. I want to talk today about death certificates because I've got a couple comments about how deaths are miscoded, like sometimes heart attacks are coded as COVID. And I think this is a misunderstanding, which I can clarify.
What public health or pandemic developments are confusing? What do you want Dr. Kat to demystify? It's 800-642-1234. Katrine Wallace is an adjunct assistant professor at University of Illinois at Chicago School of Public Health. She's known as Dr. Kat, epidemiologist on TikTok, where she makes public health videos. Kat, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello, welcome for thank you for having me.
So what got you started in making these videos on TikTok?
Well, at the beginning of this pandemic, I really thought that I would be talking about, you know, I noticed there's just a lot of misinformation online when I would kind of be looking through my social media feeds or even kind of in the regular media, I was just noticing some either misunderstandings or misconceptions about how deaths were coded or, you know, just how things were done on a public health level. And so I really thought that there would be just an opportunity for me to kind of talk about these things on social media, because there's just a gap between the scientists doing the science and then the regular lay people that weren't going to read the scientific literature. So I thought there was a real opportunity as a scientist to kind of speak directly to people that way that maybe wouldn't otherwise read the scientific literature.
Yeah, you know, TikTok reports it has about 850 million monthly active users. Why this social networking platform?
So that's a great question, actually, because I wasn't even on TikTok before the quarantine kind of started in March. I was on Facebook and Instagram, and I still actually maintain a presence on Instagram, but TikTok gave me a great opportunity to create and edit videos within the app. And also it has a kind of for you page function where my videos that end up doing well get pushed out to a lot of users. It has like this algorithm that pushes out your successful content to a lot of users. So actually it enabled me to build a following actually very quickly. I was really surprised at how quickly and how interested people were in my content. So it actually just kind of grew a lot faster than I would have expected.
And our natural question here, is it a younger audience that you're trying to connect with on this information?
So I think it is a younger audience. It's definitely mixed. I don't have in my analytics a breakdown of the ages like you do on some of the other social media apps, but I know a lot of the people that follow me are healthcare professionals, because I can tell from their comments, and I've actually become friends with a lot of healthcare professionals and other public health people on the app, which is nice. But there are also a lot of younger people too that either want to go into public health or want to become an epidemiologist, and they ask me about my path, which it actually kind of humbles me and makes me very proud to inspire people in that way. Especially during a pandemic. But yes, I think a lot of people go to social media for their news now. So being a kind of real source of information is just something that I'm compelled to do.
We're talking with epidemiologist Kat Wallace, who goes by Dr. Kat Epidemiologist on TikTok. You can join in. Have you talked with family members about the pandemic? What's been effective in reaching skeptical minds? Do you use TikTok to get your information or another social media platform? Where are you getting your information about COVID-19? 800-642-1234 to join in. So when you make these videos, you know, what is your overarching goal here? Is it just the clarity of the information? Because you have to break down something really complex very quickly. Like, good luck with that, Kat.
I'm not known for my brevity. So it's been very, I'm used to having an hour class period to discuss these kind of issues. So to me, this has been a very important exercise in being concise. So it is difficult. But yes, at first I went on to just kind of explain, I was thinking I would explain like epidemiology modeling and how we, you know, how we do things on as epidemiologists and how we come up with this information. But the questions people had and the information people needed were like a basic level of information, like when should I take a test? And, you know, it was very surprising to me just the amount of different conceptions of the truth that were out there and all the misinformation and the fact we could do a whole radio show just about the misinformation and all of the things that I've had to kind of debunk along the way. But I just felt like, you know, you can put something on TikTok and thousands of people will see it, you know, hundreds of thousands of people will see it versus, you know, in the scientific literature, these people wouldn't necessarily be getting that same information.
So, you know, in this area of misinformation, how do you address skeptics? What do you say and say very quickly?
I get a lot of skeptics. And I mean, basically you can really really point people towards a few pieces of information that really kind of are indisputable with COVID-19. And one is the amount of excess mortality we've had in the United States in 2020. So, you know, people can say that the deaths are miscoded and that it's really the flu and that, you know, I get all kinds of different theories and misconceptions kind of thrown at me. But then you can really say, you know, we've had like 300,000 deaths over what would have been expected given the data in the last 5 years in the United States. And we're actually pretty good at predicting mortality. It's something we've been doing for years. And to have this much excess mortality is really quite unusual.
You know, mask wearing has been a very contentious issue. And what about this notion that, you know, we have mask mandates, and yet we still see skyrocketing case numbers?
Yeah, so I get that question a lot also. And I always kind of remind people that mask mandates really only will mandate the mask be used in public, because that's all we can really mandate, right? No, we meaning, you know, the government, not me. But we're seeing in my area, 2 out of 3 new cases of COVID-19 are happening in homes with people gathering without masks on. And that's not a place where the state can mandate masks. So it's concerning that, you know, even though there is a mask mandate, 2/3 of the cases are happening in in-home gatherings.
Yeah. Do you think public health departments should be online more or using social media channels to convey their messages and to convey this public health information?
I mean, I think I don't know in what a capacity they would do it, but it's been pretty successful for me. And I feel like I am making a difference. Sometimes it feels like the problem is bigger than me and I get frustrated that there is so much misinformation out there. But then I remember the people that say to me, I feel like you're the only person that makes me feel like I'm not crazy. And that makes me keep doing it, because I feel like there are people out there that are trying to convince their families and their employers that this is real and that they need somebody to help them and know where to get the right information.
Kat Wallace, better known as Dr. Kat, epidemiologist on the social media app TikTok. She uses her platform to answer questions or clarify scientific findings about the pandemic. What are the most frequently asked questions you hear about life during the COVID crisis? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Kat, epidemiologist on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we have Kat Wallace on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. She's better known as Dr. Kat Epidemiologist on the social media app TikTok, where she makes public health videos breaking down complex science into digestible and more easily understandable parts in 60 seconds, I might add. How do you think public health officials can better explain infectious diseases to the public? Hey, Gen Z, are you listening? Do you get your COVID pandemic info from what you come across on social media platforms or the For You page on TikTok? Tell us about it, 800-642-1234. And Dr. Kat, epidemiologist, stays with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Lisa now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. My concern in general with the social media is, you know, even people who understand this is a crisis, what's happening, that when they engage with people, they're doing it in such a disrespectful manner. They're shaming. And, you know, when I come across somebody and I'm trying to talk with them, a lot of times they might make nastier derogatory comments back, but I continue to try and engage in a respectful way, presenting what facts I'm aware of and what I understand. And those people either drop out or they will then start engaging with me and we have a discussion. People would try to discuss it rather than shame or be nasty or rude.
Lisa, thank you for that. And, you know, trying to be respectful there is Lisa's through line, Kat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. So I will say that there is a divide between people that believe that masks absolutely don't work or that masks make you sick. And then there's people that are sort of more on the side of public health that believe that masks are actually saving lives. So it's very difficult when people kind of, and I don't absolutely condone any kind of nasty behavior, but it's hard to see the side of people that refuse to wear masks to me, because we do know that masks work as source control, and people are very against them. And we have a lot of data that masks work as source control, which means that it protects the environment from your respiratory droplets, which is how this virus transmits. So it's, you know, there's a profound misunderstanding, I think, how masks work. Like, people think masks are meant to protect the wearer, and there isn't a lot of data to support that. But there is a lot of data supporting that if everybody wears one, it controls the spread of respiratory droplets into the community, which is how the virus spreads. So it's hard, I think, for people that understand that and want to save lives. It's hard for us to hear that people refuse to wear them. So I think that's why some of that vitriol is going on. And I'm sorry that happens, but it is kind of a hot button issue, I guess.
We're talking with epidemiologist Kat Wallace, who stands out with her Dr. Kat Epidemiologist TikTok videos that break down complex scientific things and use clear language. She's taking your questions about COVID and what you want to know about it. 800-642-1234. Richard is joining us from Oneida County. Hi, Richard. What's your question?
Yes. Hello. I'm curious about COVID-19, and it's going around that if you have the flu and COVID-19, they'll both test positive. Is the COVID-19 testing positive for flu and not COVID-19?
No, they're both separate viruses with totally distinct genetic material, so the test for one would not show up positive for the other one. So I think there is a lot of misinformation kind of being spread online that the flu is gone or that now everything is being coded as COVID. But in actuality, in the Northern Hemisphere, our flu season only just started about 4 weeks ago, and our flu activity is always very low at this time. It peaks in January, February. So, you know, and in the Southern Hemisphere, they actually did have a more mild flu season, but it wasn't because testing was faulty. It's because that the Southern Hemisphere's flu season happened during our summer, because mm-hmm. their seasons are opposite. And the same things that prevent COVID-19 with the respiratory droplets also prevent influenza.
Richard, thank you for that question. You know, Kat, there are dashboards galore, numbers flying at us every day. Yeah. And often, you know, reported information from local, state, and federal officials may not overlap, may not be the same. How should we make sense of these dashboards and the sea of COVID data?
So actually, when I was preparing for this interview, I was taking a look at the Wisconsin dashboard. And I actually think your dashboard, I look at these all the time, as you might imagine, but I think your Wisconsin dashboard is actually fantastic.
Wow, cool. Okay.
I actually really, you guys break it down very, I think it's very easy to read and very, I think it's really good. And I like how you guys have the percent positivity by person and by test, because I think that's misunderstood out there. People think that all the tests are just being counted as a positive person, but on your dashboard, it's very easy to see that's not the case.
Okay.
Even if someone tests multiple times.
Well, with that being said, there the data is it, you know, you break it down in so many ways, but how important is, for instance, to look at long-term trends or to pay attention, maybe not just day-to-day numbers, but, you know, more of longer-term numbers?
So that's, trends are very important with COVID-19 because this virus spreads exponentially. And what I mean by that is if it had, every person is going to infect more than one other person in this, and in this case, we think it's the average is about 2.5. So when you look at Wisconsin's trends, it took about 7 months for you guys to reach 100,000 cases. And then it only took 36 days because of the amount of virus in the community. It only took 36 days for you guys to double that to 201,000. And then just another 18 days to reach 300,000. So that's what, where the trends come in, and that doubling time, and that, you know, that is really, in the tripling time, that's really important to look at, because that's how you can see the exponential spread in the community.
What advice do you have for people who are making plans for Thanksgiving next week?
So Thanksgiving is there's, I think every public health agency at this point has issued a kind of very strong suggestion that we should not be having traditional Thanksgiving with people outside your home where you don't live with, that you don't live with. Like I was mentioning at the beginning of my segment, is that like 2 out of 3 in my area of new cases of COVID-19 are because of in-home gatherings without a mask on with people that you don't live with. And, you know, a Thanksgiving dinner, obviously you have to take your mask off to eat. It's just very concerning given the amount of community spread we have. It just isn't suggested.
When do you recommend someone gets a test for COVID-19?
So that's a great follow-up question, because a lot of people are like, oh, well, if I just get a test, then I can go to my grandma's for Thanksgiving. And it's not that simple, because the test is really most accurate at like days like 5 through 7 post-exposure, really days 6, 7 is what we kind of recommend. And if you're out every day at work and going to the grocery store and seeing people, it's hard to know when an exposure would have taken place unless you quarantine for a week before taking that test. And at this point, you really don't have that time before Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Joshua is joining us from Watertown now with a question. Hi, Joshua.
Hi. Yes, I have a question. Well, it's rather an observation. NPR reported that the COVID-19 test, according to the CDC, is actually doing an investigation based on 30% of the tests were flawed. At least 30% of the COVID-19 tests were inaccurate. So positive cases were becoming negative, and negative cases were becoming positive. So I wanted to know from the epidemiologist, has she heard that report? Because NPR actually reported on that.
I actually haven't seen that report.
Yeah, and you know, certainly it is a concern as to how, you know, how reliable our tests. Rapid tests have been said to be more of like a triage type test that you want.
Yes, yeah. That's right. Yeah, the rapid test is better for, it's kind of like, you know, if you think about it, you have different levels of testing for like you know, screening versus like real diagnostic testing. So if it's a healthy population that wants to just kind of test like schools, you know, if you want to give rapid tests to children in schools that are asymptomatic, that's perfectly appropriate. If you have, then if somebody came up positive, you'd want to repeat that with the PCR test, which is more sensitive.
So as we start to wrap up here, what are you watching for on the vaccine front?
So we have two exciting vaccine categories or two vaccine candidates that have given interim analysis data, which showed like an over 95% efficacy, both of them. So that's very exciting. And last night, Dr. Fauci was on TV talking about how he was envisioning this to be rolled out, you know, to high risk populations by December, January. So that is very exciting.
Kat, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kat Wallace, an adjunct assistant professor at University of Illinois at Chicago School of Public Health. She's known as Dr. Kat, epidemiologist on the social media app TikTok. Coming up, we catch up with two childcare providers as they navigate running their businesses in the pandemic. Parents, is your child at a daycare center? How is it going? What have you learned? 800-642-1234. We'll check in on daycare operations after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're checking in with daycare centers here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Questions, they remain about how COVID affects kids, how safe centers are for children and their families, and how daycares respond when there is such high transmission in the community. It's really hard. Let's dig in and hear how your daycare center is functioning and what your family has decided to do. 800-642-1234. Abby Cruz is executive director of the Playing Field Child Care Center in Madison. Abby, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have Corrine Hendrickson, a family child care provider in New Glarus, and she runs Corrine's Little Explorers. Corrine, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you. Well, great to be back.
Well, Corrine, it's been 8 months already since we last talked. What is the status of your center?
Well, I did reopen this summer in June and had lower enrollment at first. And then now that school has started, my teacher's children have come back. I am supporting virtual learning here, though. So the children that I have that are in 4K, kindergarten, and first grade are actually staying here, and I'm supporting that as well as running my normal child care. And then I normally have a preschool program I run, but that is closed at the moment.
Do you have spots available, and do you have enough staff?
I am a family child care provider with no staff. Myself, I can't find anybody for substitute at all, though, to make meetings or doctor's appointments and things. So that's affecting the parents. And then I am full at the moment.
Abby, how is the Playing Field doing?
The Playing Field is doing well. We also reopened our original location in June. And in September, we started a second location in the middle of all this pandemic. So that's been quite a challenge, but also very rewarding because we know we're doing a service for families that really need our help.
When, Corrine, you see the transmission rates so high, the case numbers so high, have you approached anything differently in your center for your families?
Yes. So I am, again, just doing virtual. So the children I have here are all choosing to go virtual. Our district allows that. And then I have moved to a completely outdoor program minus nap time. So we are outside from the time that they show up at 7 until 4. I have rain gear, outdoor gear. The kids are coming in layers. It's been interesting as it got colder, but now it got a little warmer. So we're holding on tight a little bit. So that has definitely changed. Parents aren't allowed into the program. They're just coming to the gates basically outside and dropping off and picking up their children. So yeah, it's just been more nerve wracking. When a child normally has a runny nose, it's not a big deal, but now you're sitting there second guessing yourself.
Abby, what is that like for you to have to second guess every decision? Is this exhausting?
Yeah, it really is exhausting. I think the word decision fatigue has had all new meaning for me. During this time, it feels like every week there's some shifting priority or shifting guidelines or something that we hadn't anticipated. And so it does feel like we're just being bombarded with decisions. And a lot of the decisions I don't necessarily feel qualified to make. So that makes it additionally difficult to be assured that I'm doing the right thing.
What are some of those difficult decisions that you're encountering?
Well, as Corinne mentioned, you know, every time a child has any symptoms, we're wondering, should this child be excluded? If this child is excluded, should their siblings be excluded? And every one of those decisions has a ripple effect, right? Like if we keep the children there, then our staff feel more at risk. But if we exclude the children on a regular basis, we're impacting our parents, many of whom do essential work, and their ability to do their jobs. And so there's always just this balancing act of trying to make the best decision you can with every set of circumstances.
You see the domino effect. Yeah.
Yes. And the stakes are high, right? I mean, none of us want anyone to get ill.
Yeah. Corinne, how are you making ends meet? You're full now, but you have to buy the PPE. You have to make sure that you have the supplies you need to stay outside with these kids all the time. How are your financials doing?
So because of the grants, I am able to tread water, basically. The grants from DCF, from the CARES Act, initially from March that were allocated in June and July, helped kind of pay back what I had lost and helped offset the cost for the parents, because over the summer, because of the grant, I allowed them to do attendance-based to really encourage them to keep their home, their children home as much as possible and to not feel they had to bring their child because they had to pay me. So I did an attendance-based over the summer, and then I also was able to procure the with We're All In grant from the state that was for small businesses, and then we just got another allocation round this last month, and Monday was another payment, and that's basically helping offset the cost of me not having my preschool program. And again, those extra costs, I bought a filter system, air filter system, having the windows open when it's colder just to keep that airflow going. So those grants have basically helped offset those costs and have helped me stay in business.
Abby, have you used the grants as well from the state?
Absolutely. We did this a lot of the similar things to Corinne. We went to all outdoor classroom spaces. We had to add fences for, you know, four extra play spaces. We went to reduced number of children with a greater number of staff. And because each pod is isolated and can have no connection with any other groups in the center. And so there's been a lot of cost, and those grants really have made that possible.
We have Brooke here who sent an email. Brooke is the owner and director of a group child care program in the rural part of the state. Before the pandemic, Brooke had over 100 children enrolled with wait lists in every age and 12 teachers. And today, Brooke has 41 children enrolled with four teachers. And Brooke says she can't find the teachers to work and says it's because of wages. Currently, a bachelor's degree in early childhood education is the lowest pay yielding degree you can get. And so Brooke is really feeling stuck. I wonder, Abby, what would you say there?
I think Brooke is absolutely correct. I think that the pandemic has highlighted the need for early childhood professionals to be elevated and treated with the respect and compensation that they deserve. The average wage, I think, is $10.60 an hour. And if you really think about the work that these people are doing, that is not even close to adequate. So we need to come up with some solutions that don't pass the cost onto families, right? It's families can't afford to pay any more for childcare than they're already paying. But our early childhood workforce is in need of both better salary and better benefits.
So if a child is out because of COVID, does that family have to pay for those 14 days to keep that spot?
Are you asking about in my program?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So many of our children are funded by either scholarships or Early Head Start Grant or United Way funding or city funding. So none of our funded families are charged anything. With our privately funded families, they do pay tuition unless we close, and then we have a policy that says we will only charge for the remainder of the month. So if we charge, you know, if we charge once a month, so we wouldn't charge them beyond that period. But yes, for closures and even for exclusions, families are still expected to pay tuition because we still have to pay our staff.
Corinne, what is your policy on holding spots?
So my policy is kind of similar, except I did a quarantine rate of 66% of tuition if they are exposed or have to quarantine, or if I end up closing and have to quarantine. And I did the 66% because of the Federal CARES Act with the FMLA. The parents are eligible to get that through their employers for their, so they can make their payments. But I didn't want to overburden them, because if they're out of work, they're not getting paid either. But at the same time, I have to be able to pay my bills so that I can reopen.
We're talking with Corrine Hendrickson, a family child care provider in New Glarus. Abby Cruz is executive director of a child care center in Madison. And we're looking at the situation with daycare. Parents, what do you want to know about how daycares handle positive COVID diagnoses among staff, children, and family members? Are you debating closing your business because of the strain on your resources? Child care workers, what have you encountered in this pandemic? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Corrine, luckily no one associated with your daycare has tested positive for COVID, but in what other ways have you seen the pandemic affect the families you serve?
Definitely higher stress. And yeah, we've been very fortunate. No one here has. We've had close calls. I've had kids quarantined, and I've had parents self-quarantine while they're waiting for somebody they were in contact with to find out, myself included. So it's definitely a lot of stress, and then unknown of if I will be open tomorrow, if they'll be able to bring their kids, and just the extra stress of just feeling like it's closing in around us and more people that we know are getting COVID. And, you know, that's affecting families. And I've noticed just some of the behaviors of the children have changed. So I really feel that we need some more support for social, emotional, and mental health, especially in early care and education, because we don't have the resources in order to purchase, you know, having somebody come in, a consultant for $200 an hour. We just don't have that. And a lot of us just don't have the background and training necessary to help reach these kids. So, you know, that's another thing that I'm seeing for a long-term impact on these children and families.
Abby, what are you observing with the kids?
We have two different models. And at our existing site, the one that was already open, we have really focused on strong attachments. And as much as possible, we've kept the same teacher with the same group of children for as long as possible. So there's a very strong relationship there. We did group siblings together, so some of our kids did need to make some sibling or classroom changes. But I've seen the teachers really rise to the challenge to support the children emotionally. We have a strong emphasis in our program on social emotional, and we serve a lot of children who've been impacted by trauma. So I would say the training in mental health is something that we've already had in our program because of our focus. Our new program, I've seen the staff again rise to the level of the challenge that they're facing and build really strong relationships with children and families very, very quickly. Many of the families at that program have been impacted by homelessness and they're in desperate situations. So childcare is a huge need for them in terms of getting back to work and maintaining employment. But the morale on the staff, the toll on the staff cannot be understated. My teachers are struggling and they're pulling it together every day for these children. I couldn't be more proud of them. But it's hard.
Abby Cruz, Corrine Hendrickson, they run centers in Madison and New Glarus. You can join in with your situation, 800-642-1234. Still time to talk about childcare. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with childcare providers. Corrine Hendrickson is in New Glarus, Abby Cruz in Madison. Parents, are you sending your child to daycare? Are there capacity limits? How are you managing? Childcare providers, have you seen an influx in kids or a reduction? Do you have funding to stay open? Do you have enough PPE? 800-642-1234. And Corrine and Abby, stay with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Charlotte in Milwaukee now. Hi, Charlotte.
Hello. Hey, I send my child to a daycare, and I just found out that the director was gone for 2 weeks. But we're not allowed to know if you guys have COVID. So I was just wondering how, you know, she visits every room. Is my child safe?
And so, Charlotte, you believe that the director of your center was out with COVID. Is that right? But there wasn't any communication?
No communication. And I was just told that they were not feeling well.
Okay. Corrine, what would you say in the situation?
That's a tough one because the health department will work with that program to see the contact tracing, to see if that person had been within the 48 hours prior to either having symptoms or testing positive, had been around in those classrooms within 6 feet of those children. I believe the current guidelines are for 15 cumulative minutes in that 24 hours. So definitely would be concerning to me, but the health departments and the contact tracers have definitely been very, very, very adamant, especially in childcare situations, of making sure that the people who need to know did get told.
Abby, would you like to add something here?
I don't know what it is in her county, but I know in our county, the childcare would also be required to post a notice saying that someone in the building had been diagnosed with COVID-19. So she may want to check with her public health department to see what guidance they would be giving to local child cares there.
I want to look at masks for a moment here. In your centers, how are you handling masks and who is wearing them? Corrine first.
So as a family child care provider, I am exempt from the mask order. However, I decided even before that we were going to mask inside. So when we're inside and not eating or napping, the children are wearing masks. Ages 3 and up, and they're really, really good about it. It took a little bit to get used to, but if they start touching their face, I remind them to wash their hands, and I just, you know, they don't even question it. They're told to wear them because it's to help keep each other safe and healthy, and they, you know, put them on and they go about their business. But us being outside so often, they don't have to wear them as much, but I wear a mask, and the parents wear masks at drop-off and pickup.
Abby, your mask policy?
We're following the county guidelines. Everyone 5 and up is wearing a mask when indoors. And so that's what we're doing. We're also encouraging the use of face shields.
For your teachers?
We actually purchased hats for the children that have face shields on them and for the teachers as well.
Oh, wow. So the children are wearing those indoors?
They are encouraged to wear them. We have a lot of children that have been impacted by trauma, and I would say we choose our battles carefully. For some children, having something on their face or close to their face is a real trigger. And so we aren't requiring them, we're encouraging them. And like Corrine, we're trying to stay outside as much as possible. I think that's been, to me, the best strategy for early childhood programs is being able to stay outdoors. It's been used in past pandemics and effective against other illnesses. And I'm wondering if there couldn't be some resources made available to us so we could stay out longer when the weather starts getting cold, or I don't know. I've been looking at nature preschools for a lot of information on how we can keep outdoors longer.
Yeah, I wonder, like tents or special type of heating heating instruments that could be under maybe a tent area or something like that. Is that what you're asking about?
Yeah, we looked at outdoor heaters. We're trying to figure out what the rules are and what the safety issues are related to those things. I mean, it's all new territory for us. Again, we're making, you know, lots of decisions that we haven't had to make before. But I feel like the mask issue has got such, you know, there's repercussions with the mask. I'm wondering about infants who need to see facial expressions. They get information about the world from looking at the faces of adults. They learn to speak by watching the mouth move. Children really get a lot of information from the face about emotions. And I'm really concerned about the length of time that children might be spending with masked care providers.
Yeah. Corrine, what kind of effects do you think masks are having on how your children learn?
Again, we're mostly outside. So I think in this entire time since June, we've been inside 2 days because of thunderstorms and one morning because it was so cold that the Chromebooks won't work for the children to be able to do their virtual learning. So really, I don't feel like it's having a lot of impact again, but that's because we're outside. If we were inside, I do have a mask where the lips are clear so that the younger ones would be able to, because that is definitely a concern of the speech and being able to read the lips and see how the lips move so that the children learn how to properly form the sound so that they can speak as they get older.
Talking with Corrine Hendrickson, family child care provider in New Glarus. She operates Corrine's Little Explorers. Abby Cruz is executive director of the Playing Field Child Care Center in Madison. Taking your questions about what to do with child care during the pandemic and how your center is approaching its operations. 800-642-1234. Abby, in the situation where one of your teachers would test positive, what is the protocol?
Well, the first thing that we do is contact the public health department and follow all the guidance that they give us. We have had cases of COVID, and we have closed the individual classrooms that were impacted. Fortunately, we haven't had, you know, a big spread. It's been pretty limited within those classrooms, but they're immediately closed. The classrooms are immediately closed. All the parents are immediately notified. We've asked permission of our staff to let the parents have as much information as they're comfortable with us sharing. And none of our staff has had a problem with that. They've wanted to be very transparent with families and give families all the information that they need to make good decisions for their children. And then the centers remain closed for the two-week period and undergo cleaning before they're reopened.
When those teachers are out in those 2 weeks with COVID, are they paid?
Yes, our board made the decision that we would pay teachers for the first 2 weeks. And then after that, we would evaluate based on our budget and what resources we have available. To this point, we have not had to make the decision to have people out without pay or to lay anybody off. And we're really grateful for that. But it could happen if this continued to impact us regularly and it hit our income hard enough.
Corrine, what will we learn through childcare once this pandemic is behind us? What will be some of the things you take with you from this experience?
Well, definitely that we need to be invested in, because even before the pandemic, we were struggling. 69% of family child care had closed between 2010 and 2019, and 10% of group centers throughout the state. There was already areas where there was one slot for every three children. And as a state with a very low unemployment rate and a very high mother working rate, over 70% of our households have all available adults working. So without child care as the backbone, there is it's going to just trickle right through the economy. And it was already happening with $3 billion lost annually, according to a study done by the Wisconsin Governor's Advisory Council in 2015. So there had already been a lot of advocacy going on pre-pandemic. And I feel like now families and employers and communities are really understanding it. And WECA and Kids Forward is doing an infant toddler policy project where we're going to be asking for $60 million in the next budget. And that's to help, you know, stabilize infant and toddler, because that is the number one area that parents can't find. As a family child care provider, I can take one child under the age of two. I currently have 10 people who are pregnant or just had babies on my wait list. And then increasing the subsidy so that those parents who are low income can find a place for their child and afford to pay the copay. And then it also has been a study done that the true cost of care for infants and toddlers is $24,000 a year. And right now the average cost is $12,000 in the state. So that means that our programs are subsidizing $12,000. And as Abby had brought up before, it's the teachers' wages that are getting impacted. And we can't get good, high quality teachers to come into the field or stay in the field if we cannot pay them for what they're worth.
Well, Corrine and Abby, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Take care. Abby Cruz, Executive Director of the Playing Field Child Care Center in Madison. Corrine Hendrickson, family child care provider, operates Corrine's Little Explorers in New Glarus. Just ahead, we hear how the pandemic is straining romantic relationships. Has the pandemic brought marital strife or brought you closer together? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.